mystery base.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Ginny.
I'm Jen.
And we are the Art History Babes.
We're two of the Art History Babes here. We're
half of the Art History Babes. This is one of our series of the Virtual Realism Artist Talks. So Zach Clark and I, who couldn't be here today, have curated a online exhibition selecting works from artists, and we've been lucky enough to speak with some of the artists in our show. And so today we're joined by Deborah Root. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Welcome.
And this is a slightly unique virtual realism episode because for context for you, Deborah, and for listeners, you know, there are four of us in the Art History Babes collective. And sometimes there'll be all four of us on episodes. Other times it's just a couple, and we have side projects and all that. And so virtual realism has been a collaboration between the Art History Babes and Zach Clark through National Monuments Press. But it's largely been me and a little bit of Nat working on this. And Jen has, you know, we all have like other jobs and things that we're doing. And Jen recently was like, oh, Deborah Root, like, I know her. I know her work. I researched
I know you.
And that just seemed way too cool and serendipitous to not bring Jen on to talk about your work and to talk about research interests that the two of you share. So this episode will be a little bit of a hybrid of talking about your work that's in virtual realism, but also the really cool and fascinating topic of cannibalism in art history. So, but we'll kind of start with Deborah, like if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself and talking a bit about your background, and then in particular the piece that you submitted to virtual realism.
All right. Well, I live in Canada now in a quaint hamlet in Ontario, but I grew up in Seattle in a suburb. And I have been making work dealing with some of that stuff because it really was the belly of the beast in a way. It was the heart of the American dream for many. It's what everyone was supposed to want, but those of us growing up there often had a hard time. We were alienated for a whole range of reasons. It seemed like a dead zone. And, you know, even now I look at work like David Hockney's work, and I just see a dead zone.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see if I could paint it and paint the alienation that I experienced and that a lot of my friends experienced. And so the question is how to do it. So I tried to play a bit with composition and with fragmentation. I didn't want to make the people grotesque like George Grosz did when he was doing like the bourgeoisie or whatever in Weimar, but I wanted to show how something didn't work, even though it in theory looked nice. So this has been what I've been working on. I've been doing other work with my friends, images of my friends in social situations. And also recently I've started looking at tourism. What do people want when they go to the holiday paradises? So I've looked at a lot of work in my life, but I never made work. I'd been living in downtown Toronto. Most of my friends were artists, which probably should have been my first clue. But then when I moved out here, I had space and I could start playing with these things without fear and just learning technique and figuring out what it was I wanted to say, what was important about it to me, and then just trying to learn how to do it. And YouTube, you know, like how do you glaze, this sort of thing. So the image I have in virtual realism is the Nordstrom box. So Nordstrom being a store, and it's the Christmas present. And, you know, people are not really relating to each other, and they're not even quite relating to the gift. They're just there in their windowless monads, you know, yeah. just completely separate, trying to deal with all of this. And I wanted to use bright colors because of the kind of surface quality of those interiors. You know, in real life, the interiors might have been more subtle, but still there was such a focus on what stuff looked like. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do it fairly large and all of that stuff. So when I saw the call for virtual realism, I was really interested because thinking about Stalinist art, and for my generation, I looked at a lot of Maoist art from the Cultural Revolution when I was in university.
Yeah.
And I remember one in particular showed like the Revolutionary Guard opening the door on the bourgeois, and the guy was smoking and he had books and he had like liquor and that sort of thing. And he was horrified and guilty. And just thinking about how these images were very graphic.
Yeah.
So they were, it was poster art. So I wanted to kind of bring that in a little bit too. So
totally.
Where I'm from with that.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And your the Nordstrom box, like that kind of flat graphic expanse of color and something that's very vibrant where it's and that's what really I agree connects to you know, like socialist realism in the sense of images that are very clear to read, right? Because, you know, the whole point is to like, here's what you're supposed to feel in this environment. Here's the message that's coming through. But then your work is fragmented, and it's fragmented in especially this piece in a very subtle way. Like you don't notice it at first. Like you're looking and you're like, oh, I see what's happening. People sitting around, you know, a coffee table, and it's the holidays and someone's opening a gift. And then you're like, oh, there's like a little fragmentation here. Can you speak a little bit more about your use of fragmenting like that and what kind of your thought process is behind that?
Well, with that piece, that's really the first one I was playing with that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to take it and just move it around a little bit exactly so you wouldn't notice it right away because people's experiences were fragmented. In my more recent work, I do it way more obviously and play with the sizes of people and all. And in the more recent work, the idea is that, you know, with memory, it's inevitably in fragments. There are these little bits and these pieces, and we see it in different ways.
Yeah.
In the Nordstrom box, I wasn't as aware of that. It was more trying to amplify the disconnection between the characters. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I could have gone farther with that in that piece. But, you know, it's what I was doing then.
Yeah, for sure. And so what you're working on currently in talking about doing the fragmentation more and like really emphasizing that, are you still thinking of a lot of these similar themes as you were thinking of with the Nordstrom box about like the disconnection and the kind of alienation between people?
Definitely. Yeah. So I have one that's of a group of us in somebody's cottage or whatever, and nobody's looking at each other.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know, the photos we take of each other, it's always the way. Nobody connected. No one really looked at each other.
Yeah.
And with the one I'm working on now with tourism, I had a kind of version of a Caribbean life on and off. And I'd always look at the tourists and the way they'd walk, the way they moved through space as if they weren't there. Mm-hmm. And the experience is by definition fragmented because they fly in, they have their great colonial experience where they're waited on by darker skinned people and then they leave. Mm-hmm. And so how to represent that. So with my work, I really go from the ideas to how to make it visual. You know, I used to do more writing and then you say it and you have to polish it up and all of that. But it's more interesting with visual art because you have to show it in a way.
Yeah, I'm always very impressed by that, especially, you know, because from our background, as being art historians, you know, all of us have made art and, you know, taken art classes. I don't think any of us would necessarily consider ourselves artists outright or visual artists outright. But that, you know, these themes you're talking about, because what I'm thinking about too, I'm talking about them like, oh, what have you read? You know, like what conceptual theoretical works have you read to kind of get these ideas moving more too? So I think about that, but then I agree that these concepts that we see and that we notice, like of people traveling, of people going to places, and just kind of existing there, but not in any real kind of meaningful way, or that they're actually present. And that sort of fragmented reality and of people like being in a space, shared space, but all being disconnected from one another, and how that would be difficult to convey visually, in a way that people can break that down. And it does require some like discussion about it. And that's what I think is so valuable, in visual art in general, and like the conversations that art historians have, where we're looking at, these works that on the surface were like, yeah, like I was saying earlier, you know, people sitting in a living room, but there's all these ideas and there's all these emotions, that are under that surface to kind of talk about, and unpack. And I think the tourism theme is really interesting as well. And especially in, you know, like the post-colonial area where we're, you know, talking a lot more about like post-colonial theory and ideas of people traveling to foreign places and, you know, being waited on by the people that are native to those places that have been colonized by, European and Western countries. That's really very interesting. I'll have to see what the latest work is on that. That's very
cool. I should say, I have no art history background. I never studied it. I've kind of fell into it when I started working on French Orientalism and an anthropology. And of course, that was considered very problematic by the department, because I'm talking about like Europeans and how they represented difference, not about whoever the normal subjects of anthropology. So I sometimes wonder if I'd really studied art history, if things would be different, because it may have changed quite a bit. But I feel art history is an incredibly conservative discipline, in part because of the background and connoisseurship and all of that. And then, you know, you look at these weird images. So like French Orientalism, for example, they're problematic. And all you're reading about is brushstroke. But like, hold it. Yeah. What are these pictures about?
I agree. And I mean, I think we were lucky at Davis, because there were more professors there who I think were pushing against that really conservative, established kind of culture of art history as far as that goes. Jen, how do you feel about that? Do you feel like art history is getting a little less conservative? We've been out of the direct field for a while, albeit, but.
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Can't hear you.
Jen, you're muted.
Thank you. I don't know if that's necessarily true, at least in my experience. You know, I'm currently teaching at a city college, and my big class, my baby, is my Arts of the Americas class that I have been teaching there now for 3 years, going on 4 years. And the just the battle that I have to endure to push my class, because the only class that they want to offer, at least at this like city college level, is this survey intro to art class. And it's an art history class, but it's intro to art, which is like extremely vague. And it's literally half the class is spent teaching basic concepts like what is line, and then I get like a few weeks in the semester where I have to cram the typical survey of art history. It's Western art history. There's maybe 2 weeks where I get to focus on, I cram all of the other, you know, arts of the Americas, arts of Africa, arts of Asia, and all of it gets crammed into its own mini unit within the survey unit. And that's just the way that they want to teach. And I've gotten to teach my Arts of the Americas class one time. It was very popular. They just don't offer it because they say, like, well, not enough people want to take it. I've had a lot of students be like, I really want to take that class. And so I don't know. I think that when you deviate from a standard, like, survey, Western centric view of something like art history, you don't make a lot of friends. You're not really popular as far as, adjunct teaching goes, which is what I'm doing there. And you have to fight for your class. And so that to me speaks of a conservative attitude.
Completely. For sure. And it's interesting too, because I remember when I was applying for grad school, a family friend of mine who's an anthropologist was helping me, because, like, talk about, you know, the application process, because no one in, like, my family or immediate sphere had done like a master's degree or anything like that. So I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. So he was talking to me about the application process, and he was like, yeah, you know, I feel like art historians have a reputation of being sort of surface level in certain ways, or very, kind of stuck in talking, like, you, it's important to talk about the brush strokes and really, like, convey a visual image through your writing. That is important. But I think there's this reputation around art historians that it's not really getting all that deep, or it's just kind of recycling ideas from more, like, established art historians from, like, you know, the 19th century and even older. So I think, you know, there are some ways that envelope is getting pushed more. And I think what was great for us was doing a lot of interdisciplinary work where we weren't just reading and working with other art historians. We were reading things from anthropologists and theologists. And so I think that was very valuable in making it a more kind of well-rounded background.
Totally. And I think that our program in particular, we got lucky, because when we started our master's program, we got this new shiny professor who was, she is a post-colonial scholar from Iran. And we really had a lot of opportunity to discuss these concepts of Orientalism and post-colonialism, which I feel were just, like, things that we got to dip our toe in when we were doing an undergraduate bachelor's degree. But that's not, it was like a class, you know, one class out of the whole quarter that we would be like, well, and here's Edward Said, and what's he doing?
Yeah, at least got it. I had to learn it in the street. I mean, Said changed my life.
Absolutely.
Suddenly it's like, well, will this work with images too? But they never taught it. So your friend tells you, and then you go read it on the slide.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it really fascinating that you are talking, you're dealing with these concepts, these themes of tourism in your latest work, because I'm thinking about the, what are they called? The nomadic workers, the tech nomads who during the pandemic have gone to, I don't know, Costa Rica or Mexico or, you know, any Thailand, and they're just doing this kind of, like, nomadic work, nomadic, you know, but they get to live in some beautiful place and be waited on by brown people. And they get to have this, like, lavish sort of idea of their lives. And, like, I'm a tech nomad. I'm thinking about that lately, just because I've been distance teaching, but I also have another job. So, like, I don't get to be a tech nomad. Right. I have to go to work.
Well, in some places in the Caribbean, they actually are trying to get people to come for 3-month stints to work virtually, but live there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very weird. Like these sets of fantasies. I think the names of hotels are telling. Like, why on earth would anyone want to stay in a hotel called El Conquistador or in the Caribbean, the Plantation? I mean, it just
good.
What is the fantasy? Well, we know what the fantasy is, but right. It's still under the surface.
Yes.
And when I was in Antigua, they have this shiny new cultural center for tourists that talk about how great Antigua is and how we have the sun here so we can have beaches and have visitors. And the whole sugary economy, a veil was drawn over. Mm. And then you go into the city, the town, and there's a little local museum. And it's a very different story. And all the exhibits are about resistance to slavery and who was involved in naming them and those stories. But of course, the tourists don't want to hear that because they'll get depressed or feel guilty or something.
Right.
So this whole history is elided in these things. Same in Mexico, you know, like what, 12 million gringos have bought property in Mexico, some incredible number, you know, and they live there. And when I was living a bit north of Zihuatanejo, there was an area where there were some Americans living there, and their contribution to the local community was to teach English.
Mm.
For what? So people can work in hotels? I mean, it just
exactly.
Seemed, yeah. You know, yeah.
Yeah. That's so, it's just, yeah, it's really, I think that the nature of the privilege of those who got to do the distance work and become these nomadic sort of techie people, it just really, I think, brought all of that stuff to the surface, the the inequality, but also the desire from these other countries, these more impoverished nations that are dependent on tourism and want it. So they're like, well, please come, you know, like, yes, you can come play out your fantasy so that we can have a job. It's very complicated. It makes me mad.
It is.
It makes me mad too. I just wrote an article about it in for a book by the Mexican multimedia artist Lauriana Toledo. And her work is really interesting. She grew up in Oaxaca, and she kind of deals with the fantasy of Oaxaca and Tehuantepec within Mexico, but also notions of environmental issues and what's really happening there in the tourism. So I wrote a piece. I think it's in, I don't know if it'll be out in English. They had it translated, but it made me think a lot about Mexico because I, you know, I'd been there and, but the kind of large scale tourist thing, like in Yucatan, you'll like this, Jen, they have like these fantasies of Aztecs and Mayans for the tourists where they can sort of go experience some of that.
Mm. Yes.
So local people are hired to kind of play these particular kinds of roles that are scary because they're Aztecs, you know, this kind of thing. And it's just so bizarre because it's these same old tropes recycled from like the 16th century, but that's what people want. And they feel like they're having this touch of authenticity. And now that particular place is run by, you know, Mexican big money. It's not U.S. big money, but like, what's the difference really?
Exactly. Yeah. That's really fascinating. I want to read what you wrote about this artist who I've not heard of, Lauriana Toledo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for that. If it's in Spanish, that's fine. I'll read it. yeah. So
yeah, that's fascinating.
I'm very interested in all of your work, Deborah. And you know what? I did not know that you were a visual artist. So I didn't know. And it was really funny because I have just my alerts on my phone and I saw an email from the Art History Babes Gmail account. And I was like, Deborah Root? Is that Deborah Root? No, it can't be the same one. And I looked it up and I was like, I think this is Deborah Root. And I was so excited to see that because this book, your book, if you'll notice, it looks like crap because I've read it so many times. I carry it around like my little tome because this is a subject that's really near to my heart. I don't know how much you want to talk about your book and how much you want to focus on your work, but I think we can do both. So this book, it's funny because I was in my master's, I got on this topic of cannibal depictions of cannibal characters in these early 16th century Dutch like travel maps. They were right. Like these maps, but they were also these works of visual art that imagined the new world. So like the first sort of ideas of how it looked, and seeing that most of these works almost invariably featured some scene of cannibalism. So Theodor de Bry in particular has a engraving from the 16th century that is depicting, I forget who it is now. It's some great explorer is touching ground onto America. He comes into contact with America personified as the nude woman, vaguely supposed to be Indian with the headdress, but a very European body. But then you see in the back, there's this little tiny scene. They're having a little cannibal barbecue with a little leg on like a spit roast. And it was like, that's so bizarre. And I really got introduced to this work from the artist Enrique Chagoya, right. Who I wrote my master's thesis on, and the notion of re-cannibalizing the cannibals who are really the Europeans who came to this world and consumed. Right. So I got to my second draft of my thesis, and then one day I found your book and I panicked because I was like, oh no, someone already did this. And but then I loved it, you know, and I found it too late. My thesis was basically almost done, and then I found your book and I was like reading it and thought, oh damn, she said this so much better than I did. And I had a little bit of a crisis about it. But now, you know, I wanted to just talk about this concept of cultural cannibalism and just kind of pick your brain a little bit about just how, you know, how did this come up? How were you introduced to this topic, or when did the idea manifest?
That's a good question. I don't even know. I've always been completely into the Aztecs since I was like in fifth grade and alienated my friends talking about it. And I think that, you know, I read the same stuff that I'm sure you read about the early conquest period and how they had to call people cannibals to legally conquer them.
Yes.
Because it went against nature, supposedly. And then just thinking about the ways in which a notion of difference had to be produced in order to justify this sort of thing. And I had always been thinking of it in terms of precedence. So when Europe was not very powerful, it developed these legal codes about how do you deal with infidels, with people who are different. Mm-hmm. But they weren't really in a position to do anything about it. And the legal codes were put together in relation to the Mongols and then later the Muslims. Mm-hmm. So they already had these precedents of what difference is, and do infidels have dominium over their territory, et cetera, et cetera. And then when they came to the Americas, they just applied it outright. So it seemed clear to me that that this was being applied to Mexico. And then I read a book, The Almanac of the Dead by Leslie Marmon Silko. She's Laguna Pueblo from Arizona. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing book. And one of the lines in it was, she said her people fled Mexico. They fled the blood drinkers of Mexico. Mm-hmm. And when Cortez and Montezuma met, they recognized each other. So I began to think of cannibalism as a metaphor for the state. It doesn't matter who it is. It was the Europeans, but it was also the Mexica, the Aztecs before them. And, you know, they had to conquer everybody in the Valley of Mexico, and everyone thought they were psychos when they were there. And so the way this plays out and then the way it gets represented. So I just kind of let it riff. When I wrote Cannibal Culture, I didn't want to write an academic book. I've never really been very academic. I just wanted to write my views, what I thought about this and that. Yeah. And it all kept linking up with these ideas. So given that cannibalism is kind of the worst thing in the world, supposedly, the other has to be designated as being cannibals. Also, they were designated as being sodomites. Mm-hmm. That was another justification for conquest. Sure. They were too clean. That was also an issue here in Canada, where the British were distressed that the local people took baths and so forth. So therefore they're pagan. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are all of these things. And I was interested in the content of that. And I also think the Aztecs are the Europeans' worst nightmare. I mean, to me, the Aztecs, human sacrifice, all of that stuff is, they don't do anything different in some ways than anyone else. And Montaigne pointed that out in the 16th century, in his essay, Cannibals and Coaches, mm-hmm. that, you know, if you barbecue people at the stake because they're Protestants in France, or if you do it on a pyramid, well, what's the difference? It's about the state. It's about the state deploying this violence against bodies to aggrandize itself. And so the Europeans always had to say, oh, the Aztecs are completely different. They're the other of others because of what they do, but they're not. You know, it just looks different because, like, the art was different because they wore quetzal feathers or whatever. So I just wanted to play that out and to show how that worked in a lot of contexts. So, like, in Cannibal Culture, I also talk about popular culture and these things like Madame Butterfly, these kinds of things, both in, like, European high culture, like opera, but also in film, where, so why is the Asian woman, why does she have to die to make everybody happy? That's human sacrifice. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of consumption. And I guess the last thing I was interested in is how we know that, you know, when people conquer others, they take gold, sometimes they take labor, they take all of this stuff, but they also take images. Right. And sometimes they take it and bring it into their own culture, like we saw in versions of Orientalism, but I think they also just take it and use it to justify whatever their agenda is.
Yeah.
Agreed.
100%.
Yeah, I just, you know, this concept of cannibalism, taking that ultimate taboo and reappropriating it, re-cannibalizing it, as Shigoya puts it, you know, Shigoya's uses the visual image of the cannibal in his works, like literally cannibalizing, like Picasso, a little cubist Picasso is running away from his cannibals. His characters take on this active role in his paintings that are, just so fun, like they're fun to look at, but then on a wider sense, you know, he also includes a lot of images of, like, Mickey Mouse, and Mickey Mouse becomes the symbol of American corporate culture. So showing, like, a cannibal eating Mickey Mouse, there's that famous codex that he repaints, and he shows the god of death on top of a pyramid with a little Mickey Mouse that's tied up with, like, chiles, like, on the plate, and he's putting salt on him. And these works were so just silly, but also so powerful and interesting to, like, take apart. And I feel like it was really fun to talk about cannibalism in an academic setting, because I felt like there were a couple of people in our small art history program that were like, what is she doing? She's talking about cannibals? Is she talking about cannibals? And it was just probably the most fun topic. And I think we have a lot in common, because I grew up, I'm Mexican. My parents are from Mexico. They came here, had me. I was born here, but I have my dad who, he just wanted me to be his little protege. And so when other kids were reading like Berenstain Bears, I was getting the big art books from the library with all the codices in them and seeing these images of bodies being cut open and the heart being taken out. And I was like, oh yeah, you know, I wrote a book report in the sixth grade on one of these books and got sent to the school psychologist because they,
I can relate.
Yeah, just want, like, you know, what's going on at home? Why are you looking at these books? So it's, I just think it's such a fascinating topic. And I'm wondering, how do you still engage with this theme today? Has that stayed with you since you wrote this book?
It does. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. When I first started making work, I made altar pieces, and I bought all these jewels from like a skating supply company and put them on them. And then I do these paintings in gouache and resin them. And a lot of them were like family things, like me, my mother, except as Tezcatlipoca and Quetzalcoatl. Are there Xipe Totec hands and stuff? Like, it's in my brain. It's been in my brain for so long, but it's tricky because I'm not Mexican. So I have to be extremely mindful in how I do it.
Sure.
And I may try to push it a little more with some of the conceptual stuff. Like, you know, the thing of heart sacrifice and human sacrifice continues to really interest me. I haven't been reading in the field as much. I'm really not sure what's out there. And because I'm not institutionally affiliated, I don't have access to journal articles. It's all, you have to pay,
which is
really bad. But, you know, so sometimes I see titles that look interesting. But on the other hand, it's all the same material, you know, the same primary texts. And It's weird because, like, I have theory. I did social and political thought. I was a Deleuzian. And some of these fields are very specialized, and they don't quite have theory. So, for instance, I was very interested in the Mixtec codices, mostly because of Lady Six Monkey, who was had power and exhibited it, and I was interested in how that happened. But if you look at the literature from people in the field, they don't really have social and political theory or gender theory. So it would be very possible to write on it and do a reading that might be interesting. But it's still kind of specialized. And I don't know how much I feel like going back into that kind of work. Like, yeah, I'll write articles on my friends on art, on people's bodies of work, and it'll come into that. Mm-hmm. But the real specialization, I think what you all are doing is so good, because you're carving this space for public intellectuals, which it's few and far between. Like, I think maybe there used to be more, like in the past, but I don't even know where you'd publish stuff that wasn't like some super narrow academic thing.
Sure.
Almost like fiction. And this is what I choke at, is you can do the work, but then what do you do with it?
Right. And we've talked a lot about too how, especially, you know, with our master's theses, where we put so much time and energy into researching and crafting and writing and polishing those. And we're all proud of them and thought they had, we all felt like they had really good arguments and thoughts for consideration. But then it's like, those have been read by, you know, maybe like six people.
Yeah.
And, you know, how we have this platform and we're so grateful to have this platform and to connect with people like you and really talk about these, you know, kind of like intellectual ideas, but talking about them in a way that's very accessible. And it's not, it doesn't have to necessarily be crafted like some, you know, really well structured peer reviewed journal article. It can be a conversation, and that truly reaches more people. And I do think there is very much an energy now of people wanting and searching for that intellectual curiosity and activity and outlets that are not in the traditional academic sphere, which is very exclusive in many ways.
Yeah, I think more and more. And then they're also, they're also the kind of the politics of the day. Mm-hmm. Like I would really love to do more sustained work on the historical and political and visual issues and tensions between El Norte and Mexico, you know, and how those play out and how those fall into or are get usurped and used for a range of agendas, like the right wing, you know, and what they're actually drawing on for that.
Right, right.
I mean, I believe that there's so much there to be said. And I wanted to just sort of emphasize what you were saying about like our this space that we have to discuss just any number of things that we want to, you know, what we discovered upon finishing our programs was that we, a lot of us really couldn't find a space for ourselves in the quote unquote academia. You know, the closest that I have gotten is I get to adjunct my little class at my little city college. And so for us, having this space to really engage with these topics that are meaningful to us and that we're passionate about has been, it's been good for my mental health. So
yeah.
I appreciate the kind words about the podcast because we are just really hoping to remain engaged with a very exclusionary field, a field where you are just sort of at the whim of whatever publisher wants to give you some money or what institution might, you know, dangle a tenure track job at you. So this has been a very important project for us.
That's good. I feel there's so few jobs, and even if you get one, I had been teaching in an art college in downtown Toronto, which was great. Mm-hmm. The students were very diverse. It was completely anarchic. I could do whatever I wanted, which I did, and then it changed. Awesome. And they started creating a weird hierarchy. So in a fit of pique, they gave me a pay cut, and so I got pissed off, and I quit. And I took like the tenure track job, and I was hired as a Mesoamericanist. And so I could like do my thing and do my class and listen to the students gasp at like the images of sacrifice. But it was insane. There was no time to do anything. The whole peer reviewed thing was so weird because you couldn't take oral histories or anything into account. And, you know, all the stuff that you were supposed to do. And I quit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was the right call because you're making some just amazing work that, I mean, I'm looking at all of your whole website right now. I'm just pouring through it as we're talking and I'm just delighted with this work.
Beautiful. Yeah. I mean, I think we often, what's so cool about, this podcast and what we've experienced over the last, like 5+ years that we've been doing it, is that we connect with all kinds of different people who have, you know, we have like our initial intersecting interests, visual art, but we also connect a lot with fellow people who have done like the more traditional kind of academic track and found it to be too limiting for a variety of reasons. And, you know, I think what bothered me the most beyond like the hierarchical bureaucratic stuff, because that sucks as well. But was this idea that like the further along you get, the more honed in and the more narrow your focus has to be, you know, so like it can, an idea can start about like a city or a time period. And then it's like, okay, narrow in on an artist, then narrow in on one particular work. And I just kind of felt like this narrowing lens. And I feel that once you can kind of break out of that and decide to like do something else, that's when it's just like, there's so many avenues to explore. And with people really emphasizing more like online platforms for learning and discussion and discourse, like I think that's amazing. I think that's one of the coolest things to come from the internet, and podcasts in particular. I mean, people have podcasts for all kinds of things, but you want to like learn about something. Like I was like, I want to know more about the Ottoman Empire. There's a podcast about that. And it's like people who research it and talk about it. And it's that kind of wide reaching discourse that's accessible to anyone with the interest to look for it. I think has been a really wonderful shift over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years.
And even learning how to do stuff, as I said, you know, I work in oil and I do very traditional techniques. Mm-hmm. And I learned online.
Yeah.
I love it.
That's excellent.
So amazing.
So cool.
And, you know, this stuff you learn from, like the pictures that they paint are not necessarily a thing. No, I'm not interested in like a rose with a drop of dew on it.
Yeah.
But in terms of how you get that sense of transparency.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. And that's amazing. How long have you been painting for?
3 years.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
But that's, as I said, really I've looked incredible. At a lot of work and you know, a good friend of mine who's an artist, she does installation. Well, most of the people I know are video installation people. Mm-hmm. But this friend also does painting. And she deals with political things like partition. She's South Asian. Her name's Srinder Dhaliwal. And she would always say the medium doesn't matter. It's the ideas behind it. You've got to really hone the ideas and then you'll figure out how to do it. They don't teach you in art school. So you just have to make a lot of mistakes and do it. Yeah. And I think having her say that repeatedly made it easy for me to try. And the more you try, the better you get, you know, like all these people I know who want to do work, but they don't because they're intimidated by the fact it's crap in the beginning. Of course it is. Remember when you were writing a thesis, think of the first draft, you know, it's not like the final Derrida essay, you know?
Oh my gosh.
So just do it.
Had to be drank just to put down the words, because otherwise I was like, this is terrible. I can't do this.
Yeah. I mean, we all can get stuck in terms of what we think in our minds it should be, whether it's an article or a painting or even just like a small, I get it with writing a bit, but I'm more comfortable there. So I know like the feeling and to kind of try and push past it. But I, especially over the last year and a half with all the pandemic, I've been making way more art than I ever have before. And what I've tried to do is to really push past that feeling of like having something in my mind. And then when it doesn't like look like that, or it's not matching up with how I think it should, like stopping and just being like, oh, I'm bad. And instead just like really enjoying the process of creating and making and just doing it for yourself. And that alone is valuable, and using that part of your brain and just kind of trying to overpass the fears of like, oh, well, no, I can only do this if it's going to look like this, or like, I have all these friends who are amazing artists and like they're artists, like I shouldn't make any work. And we've all talked about that. And especially like us being art historians, like art historians are often quick to be like, I'm an art historian, I'm not an artist, you know, but it's like anyone can be an artist. And I think everyone should just like sit down and like draw something, paint something, like, especially when you have like ideas and concepts to just see how those manifest in like a visual way and get them out of just your head. So yeah, it's all.
I think we have to think of the politics of art production. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure it's different now, I hope, but like my mother was 17 years old when she went to University of Washington in fine arts. She wanted to be an artist. She was like a nice girl. And it was all the boys of abstract expressionism, and they ran her out of there.
Oh, know? Totally.
It's no good. And so as I was growing up, she'd kind of paint, sort of. It was very tentative. She never finished anything. Mm-hmm. Then much later in life, she just decided to do it anyway, and it worked for her. But the kind of stunting and the way she took it on and felt that it was because she was bad, because she didn't have feminism.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, that's huge. And I think that has probably happened for many people, and many women and women identifying artists who have just felt like particularly more boxed into like, oh, you know, good art looks like this. And if you can't do that, you know, like, and that's whole attitude too of like doing work somewhat timidly or tentatively, I think often gets associated with women. It's like, oh, you know, like a little unsure and a little that. And it's like, you know, I think it's getting better now in terms of like, just fucking make something, you know, just like however you want it to look, just like do it and do it, you know, without worrying about how it's going to be received and how you're going to be compared to people. But I do think it is getting better in that way, hopefully. But there's all progress to be made on all fronts.
Yeah, Jen, do you make work?
I do, but it's the same thing that we're just talking about, where I'll start something and I'll be like, yeah, you know, I'm really feeling it this time. And then I get to a point where I'm like, oh, I don't know if I like this. And then I never finish anything. That's the thing. And I don't think that I have finished a work of art since I was in college and I took an art class that I had to finish because it was for a grade. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, where I'm at right now with my career and with what I want out of my future. I'm just turned 32 and I'm working at I'm working a full-time job at a place that has nothing to do with anything that I care about, just to pay the bills. And I'm, you know, this is the podcast is what I love, the teaching, while mind numbing. I do love it more than at least some of the other things, but I was really thinking a few days ago, like, God, I just want to quit my job and make art. I just want to do it. Mm-hmm. And I might. So I think that I'm very inspired by people who have this more traditional route and then decide like, I'm going to make art, and then they do it. And it's really amazing. I mean, and I think that what you're saying about your mom and then how you've sort of been doing this self-taught process with your work. I mean, I think that's so inspiring and it's amazing. I mean, I'm very interested in your work. I just saw the Judy Chicago retrospective at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And a couple of your pieces here give me a little bit of Chicago. I'm not really sure.
I don't know her work except the dinner party that everybody knows.
Sure. I mean, she's making some very interesting paintings. She did a whole series on death, and she in this room, and they're on a small scale. So like the retablo scale type paintings that are like traditional sort of a Mexican format where it's usually a personal story, and she's using it to chronicle this idea of death. What's her death going to look like? The death of her mother. Mm. And there's just something about the way she uses color and line that I saw your work and I was just reminded. So give it a little.
I'll game. Have a look. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm meaning to go see that show.
I'm a bit afraid to deal with death. And one of the paintings, the Every Dog Has Its Day, I'm dealing with aging a bit, but it's tentative. It's like, oh, don't give too much away, you know. But you know, friends of mine are starting to get sick. It's weird. And it's the age thing is weird.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I just I made a consultation with a laser like face things. I was like, do you think you can maybe like get rid of some of these lines? And then they were like, it's $2,000. And I said, okay, forget it. aging is, it's weird. It's weird. But I think that it's a huge, huge theme. So
yeah, and it's a theme that seems difficult to work out in artwork, but very worthwhile, I would think. Yeah, and you know, I my dad is 66, 67, and he's had a few friends who have gotten very ill and a couple who have passed away, and he's talked a lot about how strange it is to like be in that part of his life. He's like, you know, conceptually you know that you'll get there, but it's another to experience it. And I would imagine that would create a big shift potentially in your art.
And it's not talked about. And yeah. In my case, I have 4 parrots. Cool. So
I love them. Time,
you know, so thinking about that, about you have to like plan and do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, Deb, as one bird lady to another,
you know, more things that draw the two of you.
I know. When I looked at your thing, I thought, I'm interested in everything she's interested in.
Yeah. Amazing. I'm turning my house into a birdhouse.
Got a bunch of my birdhouse. 2 African grays, 2 caiques.
Oh my goodness. Wow, what sweet babies.
Beautiful. Well, Deborah, this has been such a pleasure talking to you and you know about all kinds of themes, and in your work that's in virtual realism is stunning, and it has so many interesting concepts, and Zach and I really enjoyed learning more about it and including it in the show and all of that process. And you know what we do for all these episodes is in the show notes. So when people just kind of scroll to the bottom of the podcast as it's playing, we have links to websites and everything. But we also ask if you would like to share like your website and where people can find you that would like to see more of your artwork and learn more about you. You can go ahead and let them know verbally, and then we'll link it at the bottom as well.
Okay. Yeah, please share the website. And I must say, I wanted to say that I feel that the curation of virtual realism is wonderful. It's a Thank really you. Interesting show. And the way it's come together and the artists you picked, and you know, everybody's different, but everybody is kind of working it.
I know. It's come together really wonderfully. And that's one of my absolute favorite things about curation is, and especially like when you have a theme that's, you know, it's somewhat specific, but we also tried to make it open-ended to just see what came in, and then bringing things together, and it weaves this whole new kind of story where it's all very different artists working in a lot of different mediums and working through a lot of different ideas. But like you said, there still is this kind of thread that pulls everything together. That's really beautiful to see. So thank you for being a part of it. And thank you for talking to Jen and I about fragmentation and colonialism and tourism and cannibalism and art and academia. This has been such a treat. Thank you.
You're very welcome. It was really awesome to meet you. I'm a big fan. I'm going to be scouring the net for whatever you're out here doing. Let's be friends. Let's
I would talk like birds. Very much. The things I'd love to talk to you about, so we can make that happen.
Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much. And Jenny, excellent job. This is really cool.
Thank you. Thank you again. And thank you all for listening.
The Art History Babe.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.